Welcome to Disrupting Japan, straight talk from Japan's most successful entrepreneurs. I'm Tim Romero, and thanks for joining me. Circuit boards are one of those things that are everywhere, but that we really don't think about very much. Personally, my only direct experience with circuit boards was years ago, and involved a fair amount of cursing and a lot of solder burns. But printed circuit boards, or PCBs, are a $90 billion global industry that is highly standardized, tightly controlled, and surprisingly damaging to the environment. Well, Shinya Shimizu and the team at Elephant Tech are changing that. They've not only developed the technology to re-engineer PCB manufacture to be more environmentally friendly and less expensive, but they've also built their first factory and are now selling to some of the world's largest manufacturers. Elephant Tech is a great example of how startups can succeed while making a positive contribution in this world. And Shinya also gives some great practical advice about how to sell to large enterprises as a new startup, how to raise money for capital-intensive growth, and how to introduce new innovation into a low-margin, cutthroat industry. It's really quite an amazing story of their journey from a small Kickstarter project 10 years ago to make a pen that lets you draw working electrical circuits, to selling PCB technology to some of the world's largest manufacturers today, to, just maybe, fundamentally changing the way circuit boards get made tomorrow. But you know, Shinya tells that story much better than I can, so let's get right to the interview. So we're sitting here with Shinya Shimizu, the CEO and founder of Elephant Tech, the first company in the world to mass produce printed circuit boards using a inkjet printing eco-friendly sustainable manufacturing process.
Sure.
That took longer to say than I thought, but thanks for sitting down with us.
You're welcome. So I'm really happy to be here. So
well, I try to explain what you do in that big mouthful of an introduction. But I think you can probably explain it better than me. So what does Elephant Tech do?
So Elephant Tech is going to completely change the way of manufacturing electronic circuits. It's, you know, completely change with drastically environmentally better, of course, and cost-effective way. And our goal here is like probably in 10 years or at least 15 years from now, the most of the circuit boards in the world, I mean, including iPhone, and laptop, any kind of electronic circuits are made by our technology.
Well, and I think kind of the core of your innovation is most circuit boards today are produced using a subtractive process. And you use an additive method.
Right. I said completely different way of manufacturing electronic circuit means existing way uses subtracting method and ours is additive, purely additive manufacturing. That's the biggest difference. So the conventional way is subtractive, which means circuit boards are copper wires are placed on plastic boards. That's circuit boards. And to make the circuit boards, existing way is like laminate the copper foil to the plastic board and then remove unnecessary part from the copper foil so that you use the remaining part as wires. But during that process, 80 or 70% of copper is dispersed and not used. So which is material efficiency is very bad and cost-wise it's bad. So that's the existing way. Our way is completely different. So we first print the copper with inkjet printing technology and then increase the thickness of copper by plating technology. Plating makes the copper crystal grow. So it's purely additive. So with that technology, you know, it's inherently good, right?
Right. Well, less waste all around.
Sure.
Right? Sure. So like you were claiming a 70% reduction of copper use and 95% reduction of water use and 75% reduction in CO2 emissions.
Yes.
And I was amazed at how much circuit board production contributes to CO2 emissions.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's That's probably bigger than anyone thinks. Apple, I'd say, for example, Apple is one of the biggest carbon producers in the world because, you know, they are making a lot of things. But 10% of their total carbon footprint, including their travel, including manufacturing and any kind of carbon footprint, 10% of them are from circuit board manufacturing.
So that's not just their supply chain. That's their total carbon
footprint. Total carbon
footprint. Holy cow, that is really a big contribution.
That is big. And Apple is, of course, aiming at net zero by 2030. So that 10% is significant.
Yeah. Well, tell me about your customers. So who's using Elephant Tech technology and what's their motivation for doing it?
Yeah, their motivation is mainly decarbonization, exactly decarbonization. So last year, I cannot really talk about a lot about like undisclosed clients, of course, but you know, already disclosed clients like Lighton, for example. Lighton is not the most famous company in the world, but it's a big company. So 1/4 of global laptop keyboards are manufactured by Lighton. So last year, we had a joint press release of MOU sign kind of ceremony with Lighton. Lighton's motivation to use our circuit boards is exactly decarbonization. The point is, like, Lighton's customers are normally Western countries, I would say. It's not, their customer is not normally a Taiwanese company, so they're European companies or North American companies, and they really choose supplier by environmental aspect.
I really want to dig in on how those consumer pressures are changing supply chain in general. But before we do that, I want to talk a little about you.
Right. Right.
So, I mean, you founded Elephant Tech back in 2014.
Yeah, it's long ago.
But it was AGIC, right? Yes, as a Kickstarter campaign.
Sure. Oh, you know the very well.
I've been fans of you guys for a long time.
Thank you.
Yeah, you had that cool little marker.
Yeah, it's a cool little marker.
tell us about that.
Yeah, before starting that company, so I was working for McKinsey as a management consultant. And while working for McKinsey, I was looking for interesting scientific CEs, especially from the universities. And because, you know, I believed, and I still believe, that university technologies are normally underused. So there are a lot of technology that can potentially change the world, especially in Japanese universities, I would say. So, and so I was looking for innovations. And I found this technology that is invented by Professor Kawahara, who is now the professor at the University of Tokyo. But, you know, the circuit markers, I'd say it is definitely not directly connected to our final goal, right? So,
why the Kickstarter? So, I mean, when I first saw that, yeah, I was like, oh, well, that's kind of cool.
Yes.
But, you know, what are these guys going to do with it?
Yeah, so...
Did you know your direction from the beginning?
No, or? No. So this is my first company. And when I founded this company, I was 25 years old. And honestly, so I got lost, I would say. So, I mean, the technology itself was really, I would say, immature. It's not as sophisticated as what it is now, right now. So that professor's technology cannot directly print metal on plastic substrate. And all of the circuit boards are basically plastic substrate. And they started from printing copper on paper. It's interesting. And it can be a good seed, but copper printed paper cannot be used for industrial use, right?
Okay, so just from the outside, I was watching you guys go from like the handheld markers for drawing circuits to a kind of an inkjet on printer, right? And now on the circuit board, but these were different technologies?
Honestly, yes.
Honestly. Really? Okay.
Honestly, yeah. I mean, so we say like to investors normally, so it's all connected, but scientifically, so these technologies are not directly connected,
okay.
I'd say.
Well, I mean, I guess there's a lot of kind of know-how and experimentation that connects them.
Sure. But you know, so the first period is like not directly connected to what we are doing currently, but during that process, I found that many people, at least more than I expected, are interested in new technology of manufacturing circuit boards. and real printed circuit boards can have a significant market. Honestly, before founding this company, I knew nothing about, you know, PCB industry. So during the first period, I researched those things. And
well, so that, no, that this is really interesting. So, I mean, you were coming as an industry outsider, and you're not coming with a deep technical knowledge of the technology. So how did you develop the new technologies for each generation of progress?
Well, honestly, I am the first author of the patent we are using currently. And I'm kind of weird guy. I was designed our first CPU when I was, you know, 17 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Drawing circuit diagram and designed our original CPU and build a formula car when I was at university. And yeah, so I can do research and, you know, those business opportunity investigations. So
you had to spend a lot of time going mentally back and forth between the, sure. the business needs and the...
Yeah, sure. And even now, honestly.
Still?
Still. But it's fun, right?
Well, it is. It is. I mean,
honestly, I'm a tech guy. I love technology. I love science. If I cannot do any kind of development or research at this company, so probably I will lose 70% of my fun.
I know exactly what you mean. I feel the same way. On your journey, you rebranded to Elephant Tech in 2017. So why the rebranding and why elephants?
The first honest answer here is I had a slight trademark issue. And second is like, anyway, I wanted to rebrand our company because we are completely moving from those, you know, circuit maker to industrial circuit boards, which are so different, right? Why Elephant Tech? So it's a globally recognizable original name. Elephant Tech and this logo is great when I work in China, Thailand, India, and, you know, those Asian countries, right? I mean, normally Japanese company name is kind of hard to remember.
Right? Yeah, they're not very unique.
Yeah, and Elephant Tech is really unique, right? So even in any of those, you know, Asian countries, you know, they love elephant. No one hates elephant, right?
True. Only positive associations.
Yeah. And, you know, from the beginning, our market is not in Japan. Most of the market in global, and I would say Asian countries. So, I mean, I wanted to come up with an idea, the company name that is easy to be remembered by Asian country peoples.
Okay, that makes sense. So Elephant Tech has raised around, well, over about $80 million so far, right?
$80 million, yes.
And you've raised a lot of it in debt financing.
Yes, debt financing.
So this is something that I think a lot of, we're seeing more and more of it in Japan. But I think a lot of Western founders would love to raise debt rather than equity. So how did that come about? How did you get banks to loan money to a startup?
So honestly, the biggest tailwind is the government's policy. Most of the debt we use is kind of government-supported debt. So government is not directly debting the startups, but giving debt to startups. But I mean, they have some, I don't know the word.
So loan guarantees?
Loan guarantee. For example, 50% loan guarantee for the bank or those, you know, startup acceleration policy is one tailwind, but it's not a decisive factor. Another important factor is we use the money to specific use, especially capital expenditures. So the biggest difference between a debt and equity is debt is more strict for the use of the money. So, but you know, for most startups, especially in software-based startups, the use of money, it can vary. And it's hard to have a forecast. How do you use your money over, like, you know, next 3 years? But in our case, we build a factory, so we need capital expenditures. So that's a clear use of the money. So that's one factor.
So it's moving more towards project finance, hard assets, land, and things that banks are more comfortable dealing with.
Yep.
That makes total sense.
Yep. Being comfortable is really important. And no one
for banks especially.
No one put money into the uncomfortable areas. So
let's get back into the overall marketing and the overall market for this. Because, I mean, I'm also deeply invested and deeply committed to, like, green transformation and decarbonization. Mm. It's a big part of what I do at Jira Ventures.
Sure.
But it's challenging.
Challenging, yes.
It's, most founders really struggle with bringing their products to market in this.
Yeah, we do.
You've been doing it successfully. But in a market that I would not have predicted would be a ripe one for decarbonization because, okay, it's big. Printed circuit boards, it's a $90 billion global market, but it's one that tends to be driven by very low margins and very tight operating constraints.
Sure.
As you mentioned before, there's this pressure from the consumer-facing companies like Apple to become carbon neutral, to be more eco-friendly. Is that the main driver, or are there other factors that are driving your sales into this traditionally very low margin business?
That's a great question. And there are a few, I'd say, discrepancies in this market. As you mentioned, circuit board manufacturing is normally very low margin, which means so they don't have a motivation or capability to transform their manufacturing technologies, or you know, they don't do the green transformation, honestly. But circuit board manufacturer are the full manufacturer circuit boards, right? So they need to do something. On the other hand, Apple, HP, Logitech, or those you know, global brand owners have a quite high motivation to decarbonization of circuit boards, because circuit boards is a high carbon, low price product.
Oh, I see. So from their point of view, even if the price of the circuit board increases by 10%, it could significantly impact their carbon footprint without impacting their price much.
Sure. As I mentioned, so 10% of Apple's carbon footprint is circuit boards. But the cost-wise, it's like probably less than 1%. So circuit boards manufacturers are low margin, but in cost efficiency, carbon per cost of circuit boards is very high. So set makers, brand owners have high motivation.
That makes a lot of sense. But the other thing is the subtractive process is an incredibly complex process. There are multiple steps.
Sure.
The additive process is really quite simple.
Very, very simple.
Theoretically, it should be cost competitive as it gets refined. Is that something you see on the horizon, or is there something that intrinsically makes it more expensive than the subtractive process?
Well, there's nothing which is intrinsically more expensive than subtractive method. There's simply two things. So one is volume. So one is accumulation of small improvement. Subtractive process has probably almost like 100 years of history. So all the small improvements are done, which is incredibly optimized. And the volume of the material used for subtractive method is incredibly cheap. One quick example here is like currently the subtractive method uses copper laminated plastic film. But copper laminated plastic film and plastic film itself, the price of them are almost equivalent, almost same.
Really?
That's insane, right?
Yeah. Why?
Because plastic film manufacturers do a kind of integrated line from plastic material to copper laminated plastic film. So it's a kind of integrated line. So they make it for million tons of amount. So the price is incredibly cheap, as cheap as plastic film itself. That's insane, right?
I'm surprised because copper is not cheap.
Not cheap, especially recently.
So you set up your own plant, your first plant in Nagoya, a couple of years ago, 2020, right?
Yep.
Is the plant set up as, I mean, you're mass producing things, but is it set up as kind of a first of its kind? Will you be building more in Japan? Will you be building more in like Taiwan and other manufacturing centers? What's your plan for building out production?
Great question to our next business model. We don't really want to be the world's biggest PCB manufacturer. We don't. We rather want to be a technology provider. We sell that printers and ink so that other PCB manufacturer can manufacture PCB with our technology. So our Nagoya factory is our first and hopefully the last factory owned by us. Next factory, yeah, it's going to be probably in Taiwan or Vietnam, I guess. And we are already talking with several PCB manufacturers. And we're going to sell those printers and ink, or we're going to make a kind of joint factory with existing manufacturers.
So is this technology something that an existing factory, an existing line can be retrofitted? Or is it something you pretty much have to build from scratch as Elephant Tech technology?
So you can retrofit it.
And the joint projects you're discussing, are they retrofits?
Yeah, mainly retrofitting. Another reason why, starting from manufacturing PCB by ourselves, is that industrial structure I mentioned before. PCB manufacturing itself is really low margin. It's not profitable business, honestly. And it's so tough. It's so optimized.
Oh, sure. And you're in the supply chain of some of the toughest, tightest managed supply chains on the planet, constant pressure to decrease price.
Sure. It's incredibly hard. But the reason why, not starting from selling printers to PCB manufacturers, but starting from building PCB ourselves, is like we first need to talk with those brand owners, Apple, HP, and those kind of people. Because if we start from selling printers to PCB manufacturers, as I mentioned, PCB manufacturers are really low margin and lower motivation for, you know, they have a lot of facilities that is already invested. So here we come and the existing technologies are bad, so let's change it to a new technology. No, right?
Well, no, I find this is true in a lot of hard industry. When you're looking at how change happens in shipping, logistics in general, anything that is not directly consumer facing or not... a lot of manufacturing tech tends to face the same challenge.
Sure.
And in all cases, yeah, the answer seems to be you have to do enough of it. You have to get the original clients on board yourself, get it past proof of concept phase,
yes.
And then you can move into scaling and licensing.
Yes.
All right.
This industry is, in that sense, great for startups. Because once, for example, Apple or those large manufacturers decides to use our technology, all the PCB manufacturers need to follow.
Right. Well, you know, let's talk a bit about this, because I think that foreign startups, well, Japanese startups too, have this image of Japanese enterprise as being difficult to work with and slow to work with. And yeah, they can be.
They can be.
But Elephant Tech, you guys have had a really successful series of partnerships. I mean, you've worked with like Mitsui and Mitsubishi. You had a Project Sumitomo, right?
Yep.
How did you kick off those collaborations? How did you manage to get those companies willing to work with you at sometimes a pretty early stage in your development?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this business is not understandable for general public, honestly, but it's long-awaited solution in specific industry. For the companies or people who worked in this industry, they understand the value of this innovation very quickly. So this is like nuclear fusion-like innovation in circuit board manufacturing. Everyone knows this idea. So this idea is definitely not new. So this idea has been existing for like 50 years, I'd say. More than 50 years, so people are saying like, you know, additive is better, but no one could mass produce it. So finally, so this is the ultimate solution in this PCB manufacturing that you are going to commercialize it. We buy it.
Okay, so this was not that this was technology they were familiar with, but this was an idea and an approach they were familiar with.
Sure.
And they believed in the approach from the beginning.
Sure.
Do you have any advice for other founders who want to approach large enterprise for partnerships?
So, one advice that I give all the time is never give up. I mean, so for example, with an enterprise, we tried like 5-6 times with different windows and with different counterpart. And most of the time they know we don't need it. But then finally, one counterpart, this is the idea we were looking for.
So did that tend to be like a particular department in the organization, or did it just depend on finding that right person?
Person, yeah. Person.
And they might have had a different function in every company.
Sure. Really?
So just keep plugging at it. But I guess also make sure that you have a solution they really need, that they understand.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So this is my opinion here, is like startups don't necessarily build a solution that is agreed by 100% of people. So probably 90% or 80% of people cannot understand or can refuse, but 10% or 20% of people enthusiastically support.
Well, I think that's a good point. I mean, I despite all of the enthusiasm that people have about startups and the interest people have about startups, 90% of the people will never understand the potential of any given opportunity.
Sure.
No, that's important to keep in mind. Let's talk a bit more about your international expansion. So you've just closed very recently, a 3 billion yen or a $20 million funding round. And that was just like last week, right?
Last week.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And part of that is to drive this international expansion. So do you see the bulk of that international effort being placed in the supply side, helping PC board manufacturers get up to speed on the technology, retrofitting factories, or on the demand side, educating the Apples and Samsungs and HPs of the world? How are you going to be executing this international expansion?
Well, our current bottleneck is actually our production capability, honestly. So we have significant amount of international client already, and we're talking with almost all the major electronics manufacturers. So we still have a lot of room for improvement in our supply side, because current yield or yield productivity or printer stability, and we still have those issues.
Okay.
So we need to improve it.
So a lot of it's going into expanding and further refining the production in your current Nagoya factory.
Yes, yes.
And how much, because you mentioned that's the last factory you hope to build.
Yeah, hopefully, yeah.
How much capacity can you handle at that factory before you'll need to bring in the traditional manufacturers from Taiwan and from other overseas locations?
Actually, we have significant amount of production capability. For example, we can supply to tens of millions of keyboards, circuit boards annually. So, I mean, it's significant. But of course, very small compared with the total market of PCB. But, it's okay for supplying to those laptops and those products, but not actually for smartphone. Smartphone has a digit bigger. Normally, PC is like several million to 10 million, 20 million pieces per year. But Apple manufactures, I guess, a few hundreds of millions of smartphones per year. So it's one digit bigger. So we cannot supply to iPhone, unfortunately, from Nagoya factory, but for other applications, including vehicle, PC peripherals, and those kind of the cameras, it's okay. We can supply that.
So what do you see as the main bottleneck to hitting a truly global scale where you can get into smartphones? And is it the technology, refining the processes? Is it getting the production partnerships? Is it getting Apple to put even more pressure on their suppliers? What's the big key to that scaling?
Yeah, great question. So technology is definitely one of the biggest bottleneck, honestly. Technology-wise, there are two things we need to improve. So one is productivity for mass production, and it's not performance, it's variety of types of PCBs. So there are a lot of type of PCBs. So we are manufacturing the simplest one. We manufacture single-sided flexible circuit, but there are two layers, so double-layer circuit boards or multi-layer circuit boards. And while we are printing on flexible substrate currently, so they are rigid and there are multiple types of PCBs. Technically speaking, so our technology can be applicable for any kind of circuit boards, but we are starting from the simplest one. So we need to increase our lineup of the technology.
So it's always a risk to enter a market with a more expensive product, especially in a supply chain. So how much of your expansion plans depends on increasing government and consumer pressure for these companies to hit their net zero targets versus your ability to drop your own prices as your production gets more efficient?
The former is a lot more important. So as I mentioned, the PCB is high carbon, low price product. So it can be counterintuitive, but PCB market is really a cost competitive market. But cost is not normally a decisive factor, a key buying factor, especially from startup, honestly. You know, decarbonization, its unique value added point is really, really important. And at the moment, not only PCB manufacturers, but also those brand owners are not really serious or not really eager to decarbonize the product really seriously.
Right. They're sort of doing it because they're being forced to, and public opinion can change on those type of things, right?
Yeah. My point here is like a carbon footprint reduction is just one of the value added point, one of the advantage. So what we want to supply is not the product that is green, but expensive. What we want to produce is like, this is better for environment and simultaneously cost effective. So that's our goal. But even though if we could reduce the cost by like 20-30% compared with the existing one, without those environmental value addition, large companies probably don't buy our product.
See, I think this is the core challenge, I think, that a lot of green transformation startups, environmentally friendly startups are facing. Do you have any advice you want to give to founders of startups that are trying to solve environmental problems, to avoid some of the problems that cause so many of these startups to fail?
Actually, yes. So great question. And simultaneously, that's a question I am asking to myself every day, honestly. But first point here is like, environmental motivation is not consistent. I mean, it's not true that European companies are serious on decarbonization. That is, in my opinion, not true. So it really depends on the company, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So it's not region-wise or not industry-wise. So you need to find a partner that focusing on decarbonization. So it can be like a new CEO's initiative or a new supply chain manager's initiative, or we need to find opportunity.
Well, I think that goes back to what you were saying about the enterprise startup collaborations.
Yeah, never give up.
What role do you think governments have to play in this? So everything from like the EU's new carbon import tax, California now is requiring large companies to disclose their supply chain, their scope 3 emissions. Mm-hmm. What role do you think government has to play in aiding this transformation?
Great question. And I am proposing all the time to the government, Japanese government. I'm kind of closely working with the Japanese government. And what enterprise can do best for decarbonization is actually creating demand. So buying from startup. Even if they don't actually buy from startups, so at least they need to show demand. So we need a solution that reduces carbon footprint of this part of our business, or those kind of, you know, demand declaration is really necessary. And that plays an incredibly important role. What I'm suggesting to Japanese government or, you know, several institutions is like, it's hard. So here is like democratic nation, right? So government cannot force enterprises to buy specific things. So what I always propose is disclosure. So at least enterprises need to disclose their motivation or their needs for decarbonization. They don't necessarily need to buy an exact product, but they at least need to disclose what is necessary, what they need for their net zero target.
That's a good step. It makes the consumer pressure easier.
Yeah.
It makes it harder to...
It makes VC invest in those startups better, easier.
And do you think that is enough, or do you think that needs to be followed up with legislation, which is more common in Europe, I think?
Yeah. Need to be followed by legislation. Okay. But in case of Japanese market, Japanese companies are like, I don't know. I'm not really sure this is a cultural thing, but disclosure has normally significant impact on Japanese companies. It's like culture of shame or...
Yeah, it really has a powerful impact here.
Right.
That is true. Well, I think it is just... Japan does have this pattern where they'll spend a couple of years where they'll get every company and every CEO talking about their commitment and like, okay, now we have to disclose. And yeah, it is this kind of shaming culture. It's like, well, you said you were going to be doing this, but you're not.
Yeah, disclose the exact plan, exact needs. Yeah, that makes sense, right?
It does. It really does. And it works here across the board, a lot of industries.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
Listen, Shinya, before I let you go, I want to ask you what I call my magic wand question. And that is, if I gave you a magic wand and I told you that you could change one thing about Japan, anything at all, the education system, the way people think about risk, the willingness of enterprise companies to try new technologies, anything at all to make it better for startups and innovation in Japan, what would you change?
I think I would make Elon Musk reborn in Japan.
Oh, okay.
I mean, so the reason why here is like the biggest thing that is necessary but not existing in Japan, a Japanese startup ecosystem is a huge successful case.
I mean, we do have very successful entrepreneurs in Japan, from Mikitani to Son-san, or in kind of Elon Musk-y type, maybe Horimon.
Yeah, Horimon was successful.
Well, he was, but okay, kind of,
yeah. Yeah. But when I talk with college students at the University of Tokyo, so they cannot imagine their successful role. For them, Son-san is too far, or it's hard to imagine that.
So like role models.
Role models. They are changing the world, but they are not really changing the world as Elon Musk, right? Okay. Or as Moderna. So it can be Moderna. So Moderna is innovation that could have happened in Japan.
Yeah. But didn't. But could have.
But yeah. Didn't.
But I say, so it can be a magic wand. It can be a reborn, make the Moderna reborn in Japan. But even in a single successful case that really changes the world, that is competitive in the world, not in domestic market. So Mikitani is okay. Mikitani, I really respect Mikitani-san, but Mikitani is more focusing on domestic market.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I think we have to go back to like Morita-san and like Sony.
Yeah.
For a real world-changing Japanese entrepreneur.
Yeah, but it's history, right?
Yeah, that's 80 years ago. That's 80 years ago. We need someone newer.
So
need to refresh that a bit.
Yeah. Students, so Morita-san exists, but Morita-san, right? Sony or Toyota, it's old company, right?
It's 100 right? years ago, yeah. Yeah, we need to refresh that. Well, why isn't that happening? Why aren't we seeing more of these successes? Because, you can't say it's culture, because in history there are very successful, world-changing Japanese entrepreneurs.
Sure.
So why do you think we're not seeing it right now?
Well, one opinion that is commonly used is like Japan, good or bad, has a big market. When Sony happened, Toyota started, Japan is definitely not as big as now. Currently, it's completely efficient and effective to focus on domestic market, and Japanese market is actually fascinating, right? So it's protected by language barrier, and it has significant market.
Yeah, you can make a lot of money just focusing in Japan. That's true, yeah.
Sure.
Do you see that attitude changing? Maybe among the younger, the college age students?
Well, it changed like this. 3-4 years ago, college students at the University of Tokyo are really looking for opportunities to be Elon Musk, or world-changing entrepreneurs, but recently, Japanese economy is going well, right? So going okay. So they started to lean towards those domestic market business.
Tough times make great companies.
Yeah, absolutely. And another example, role model matters, is like, at the moment, the University of Tokyo has a lot of small, successful role models. The entrepreneurs that start a small company and had a kind of small exit and get some millions of US dollars, which is significant to, you know, of course, significant to anyone, right?
Yeah. That's real money.
That's a lot of money, right? So from 5-6 years ago, people started to think like, you know, to be entrepreneurs, but those small exit happens a lot earlier than changing the world. So those small exit role models exist more, right?
Okay. So yeah, I see what you mean. So they've got role models for being entrepreneurs in general, but they need role models to dream big.
Yes. Yes. Excellent. And that's why I started this business. I wanted to be the one.
Well, you seem to be well on your way to doing it.
Yes. So this technology is really, really fascinating. So that's why I was doing this for 10 years. So this is a technology that can potentially change the world.
Awesome. Well, Shinya, thank you so much for sitting down.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And we're back. One of the things I love the most about the Elephant Tech startup story is that it is one that involves old-fashioned engineering pivots. You see, when founders today don't find product market fit, they're encouraged to pivot, to find a new problem that their product might be able to solve. And that's usually good advice. Elephant Tech, however, went old school. They kept their focus on the problem they wanted to solve, and then continued to change and reinvent the technology needed to solve it. It's risky for a startup, which is why you don't see it that often. And it's kind of refreshing. Also, Elephant Tech's use of debt financing is interesting, not only in how this particular startup took advantage of it, but in what it tells us about the future of the Japanese startup ecosystem as a whole. Now, most sensible founders would prefer to issue debt rather than equity, but most sensible creditors won't make such risky loans. In Japan, however, some of the bank-led CVCs have begun offering combined equity-debt financing deals. It's less dilutive for the founders, and it gets some new loans onto the bank's balance sheet. But even with government subsidies, they need to be good loans, secured loans. And that means these CVCs are looking to invest in startups with hard assets. So while the U.S. venture industry is strongly biased against asset-heavy, capital-intensive startups, Japan might just be tailoring the ecosystem to support them. While the U.S. clearly dominates in software startups, this funding pressure might result in strong tailwinds that allow innovative hardware and engineering-focused startups to flourish in Japan in ways they cannot in the rest of the world. And finally, my conversation with Shinya made me rethink my own position on the importance of role models. I've always said that the most useful and inspirational role models for students are founders that are just a little bit ahead of where the students are now. These are people that the students can better identify with, people more like they are. But as Shinya pointed out, while that is true, it's simply not enough. Japan also needs some wildly successful and globally successful founders to show the next generation what's really possible, how to dream big, shoot for the stars, and just maybe change the world for the better. If you want to talk more about making money while doing good, Shinya and I would love to hear from you. So come by disruptingjapan.com/show216 and let's talk about it. And hey, if you enjoy Disrupting Japan, share a link online or just tell people about it. Disrupting Japan is free forever, and letting people know about it is the absolute best way you can support the podcast. But most of all, thanks for listening. And thank you for letting people interested in Japanese startups know about the show. I'm Tim Romero, and thanks for listening to Disrupting Japan.